Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to season 11 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our series on the Umayyad Caliphate. Today's episode is just to lay the groundwork for the upcoming season so you will know what to expect, inshallah. Now, the first four seasons of the Umayyad Caliphate were featured on our paid podcast, Islamic History Exclusive. If you like to listen to that series, look for it on Apple Podcasts. Look for Islamic History Exclusive on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, or just go to patreon.com/Islamic History. Now, inshallah, we'll be using a different format this season. In the past, we tried to release a new episode every week for about 3 to 4 months until the season ended, and then we'd move on to the Umayyad Caliphate. But as I mentioned at the end of season 10, we're going to change things around. Now, when we were doing like that, doing the weekly podcasts, these would be roughly 25 to 35 minutes long. This season, however, inshallah, we're only going to release 3 episodes. At least that's the plan. Each episode will be at least 2 hours long, maybe even longer than that. I will try to complete at least 1 episode a month, but there's no guarantees. I'm aiming for quality and not quantity. However, it is my intention to try to finish this season by Eid al-Fitr, inshallah, which should be in late March 2026. If you're not Muslim and you're listening to this, Eid al-Fitr is one of the 2 major holidays in Islam, and it basically celebrates the end of Ramadan. Now, this season is going to pick up in the year 121 AH of the Islamic calendar. If you are a new listener to the Islamic History Podcast, feel free to jump right in and start listening from this episode. It's pretty easy to catch up on what's happening, though it is better if you listen to the other 4 seasons, but that's a lot of heavy work to do. But if you do want to listen to the previous 130 plus years of history, then I made a special page for this, by the way. Go to islamichistorypodcast.com/timeline. All right, so I'll have the entire Islamic history timeline. Well, not the entire timeline. I have it broken up into sections, but I have the timeline there, and I'll have links to the entire timeline, starting from the life of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, all the way up until the point of time that we are in today, which is 120 AH. So with that out the way, let's begin with a recap of the Umayyad Caliphate Season 4. The Umayyad Caliphate Season 4, that was part of Islamic History Exclusive, the paid podcast. So now you're getting basically the Umayyad Caliphate Season 5/Islamic History Podcast Season 11. You're going to get that on the free podcast, and we're going to alternate like this going forward, inshallah. So Umayyad Caliphate Season 6 will be on the paid podcast. I think you kind of get the picture from there. We'll continue doing that until I finish out the Umayyad Caliphate. After that, I have no idea what's going to happen. But that should take us at least to the year 2027. So as I mentioned, Umayyad Caliphate Season 4, that was covering the years 106 to 120 AH. This was corresponding to the reign of Caliph Hisham ibn Abdul Malik. This period marked what Khalid Yahya Blankenship calls or terms the end of the jihad state. This is where the rapid and easy conquests that the Muslims had experienced previously before this period, these started to end. The Umayyads started hitting these hard walls on their borders, like the Turks and the Khazars and the Franks and even the Indians all the way out there in Sindh and Gujarat. And all of these hard walls that the Muslims were running into were causing massive casualties. But the problem is that Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, the caliph, he wanted to maintain this policy of perpetual expansion, even though his resources were dwindling, both in manpower and in treasure. So this was leading to a crisis, which they didn't really realize yet, but it was leading to a crisis where the caliphate was militarily exhausted and financially drained. Now let's talk about some of these military disasters that the Umayyads faced. First, there was the Caucasus disaster in 112 AH. This is where the Khazar Khaganate of the Caucasus, they broke through and annihilated the Muslim city of Ardabil. This was called the Siege of Ardabil, and it was a humiliating defeat for the Umayyads and for the Muslims as a whole. The governor of Ardabil, Al-Jarrah al-Hakami, was killed, which rarely happens in previously in Islamic history. That rarely happened where the governor of a city was killed or the governor of a region was killed in battle. And even worse, and again, the Khazars broke through the city. That means all of the civilians were fair game. Tens of thousands of Muslims were captured or enslaved by the pagan Khazars. And slavery back then meant that they were taken away to the Khazar homeland, and Allah knows best what happened to them after that. Some were freed later on in negotiations when the Muslims struck back, but many never made it back to their home. Eventually, a new governor, Mardwan ibn Muhammad, who will play a major role in this upcoming season, inshallah. Mardwan ibn Muhammad, he was assigned as the new governor because a previous one had been killed. The new governor, Mardwan ibn Muhammad, eventually stabilized this region, this front, the Caucasus front, but it came after a massive effort and a lot of fighting. Now, that's the Caucasus. That's not the only hot spot the Umayyads are dealing with. It's also Khorasan. Now, Khorasan was just a meat grinder. I hate to put it like that, but it was just a meat grinder in Khorasan, Central Asia. The Umayyads had multiple devastating, they weren't defeats because they technically won, but they were what you would call Pyrrhic victories or stalemates at best. And actually, they lost some also. They were fighting this desperate war against the Turkish Khaganate of Khorasan of Central Asia, led by their Khokan or their leader, their chief, Sulu, or sometimes Suluk. This period in Khorasan included major events like the Day of Thirst and the Battle of the Defile, in which the Muslims may have technically won. I'm doing air quotes. You can't see it, but I'm doing air quotes here. The Muslims may have technically won these encounters, but they were Pyrrhic victories, and they decimated the Umayyad army. We're going to talk about that soon. Probably we're going to cover this Umayyad army a little bit more in the first episode of this upcoming season, inshallah. Eventually, however, the Muslims did have a victory, the Battle of Khorasan in 119 AH, and it was such a surprising victory. It came after so many losses that even the caliph himself was surprised that the Muslims had actually won. He had received so much bad news and so much information about losses and losses and losses that when he finally won one, he was actually surprised. He couldn't even believe it. But yes, the Muslims did win at the Battle of Khorasan, and eventually the Turkish Khaganate fell apart, so to speak. But that's not because the Muslims, though the Muslims did inflict major damages on them also. Now, the Muslims were taking on heavy casualties, but so were their enemies. Now, they weren't just laying down now. The Muslims were inflicting massive casualties on them, so the Turkish Khaganate, they suffered a lot as well, but eventually they started infighting. Their main leader, Suluk, he was killed or he died, and when he died, that led to the different groups within the Turkish Khaganate breaking into factions, and eventually they started fighting each other. So that's the Caucasus and Central Asia, Khorasan. But then we have the far regions of the Caliphate. In the east, you have India, and in the west, you have Al-Andalus, Spain, Portugal, France. The Muslims are also experiencing major defeats on these extremities of the Caliphate as well. In Europe, they are defeated in 114 AH by the Franks, led by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours, sometimes also known as the Battle of Poitiers. And that effectively ended Muslim expansion into France. They still have some more forays, but from that point on, it is more the Muslims trying to hold on to what they had than being able to expand any further. This was a hard wall in France, in Europe, that the Muslims had run up against. And then we have India. The Umayyads captured Sindh decades earlier. And they had pushed beyond Sindh into what is now modern-day India, the state of India. But even here, they had pushed all the way into Gujarat. But eventually, they just couldn't do it anymore. They didn't have the manpower to maintain that front, to maintain those borders. And Umayyad authority collapsed. And they lost perhaps thousands of soldiers in this collapse. So all they had left was Sindh. It was really just a few fortified garrisons in Sindh. So it's like I mentioned, the Muslims were running into these hard walls. They had beaten all the easy guys now. Now they're up to the final bosses, and these final bosses are not going down easily. Those are the external problems, the external enemies. But there are also internal problems within the Umayyad Caliphate. This was more societal problems that could have been fixed if the Umayyad leadership and the people under the Caliph's authority and the Caliph himself, if they abided by Islamic principles, but they did not. It begins with the Mawali. The Mawali were essentially non-Arab Muslims, though there were some Arab Mawali. But basically, the Mawali were former slaves who had accepted Islam, and they'd been freed. Now, we'll talk about this more, inshallah, when we get to the Berbers, but don't want to give away too much here. Sometimes entire populations accepted Islam immediately instead of fighting the commander or fighting the Muslim commander. And they accepted Islam at the hand of the commander, and then the commander would basically take their Islam and then immediately set them free. So technically they were kind of like slaves in a way, but they're immediately set free. But they were still Mawali. This happened more with the Berbers than with other groups, but it did happen with other groups as well, because we have tons of Turks and Persians and Indians and all these other folks who were becoming Muslim at this time, and even Greeks and a few Copts as well, C-O-P-T-S, but primarily Turks, Persians, and those are the main ones, Turks and Persians. I'm getting off my point now. Let me get back to the point. The point is that these Mawali were generally freed slaves or non-Arab Muslims, and they were basically second-class citizens. And we're going to talk about the social classes in the Umayyad Caliphate in just a few moments. There was one point of time that we discussed in the Umayyad Caliphate Season 4. The governor of Khorasan, he had promised the non-Muslims, who are mostly Turks and Persians, Sogdians, and those sorts of people in Central Asia, he had promised them that he would lift the jizya if they accepted Islam. When he did that, thousands of people converted to Islam. But now the Umayyad governor of Khorasan, he realized it was hurting his pocket. It was hurting his treasury. And he reneged on that promise. So here's the backstory on that. Now, jizya is to be applied to non-Muslims living under the protection of the Muslim government, the Muslim state. If a non-Muslim accepts Islam, the jizya is to be lifted and the Muslim only has to pay the zakat. Well, you might think, well, they're just trading one tax for another. Not necessarily. You see, the zakat has a legislated limit. We know what it is based upon the Quran and Sunnah, and we know what it has to be paid on. Those rules were laid down in the Prophet's time. You may have a little bit of disagreements between certain schools of thought based upon different things that weren't taxed during the Prophet's time, but essentially we all know what it's going to be, 2.5% of your stored wealth at a certain period of time. There's more to it than that, but this is not a fiqh or Islamic law class. Essentially, the zakat we know. The jizya can be whatever is agreed upon. Whatever the commander says or whatever the governor of that region says is going to be, then the subject people are supposed to pay it. And it could be very heavy. And sometimes when the Muslims had to fight to conquer a territory and the people were very basically trying to defend their land as best as they could, but they lost, the Muslims often levy some heavy tribute or heavy jizya on them as punishment for giving them so much trouble and killing so many Muslim soldiers and all the problems that they caused. They would levy heavy jizya against them. And so with zakat, you know what to expect. Jizya, it could be a lot more. In the early days of Muslim expansion, during the times of particularly the last few months of Abu Bakr's life, much of the expansion was done during the lifetime of Umar ibn Khattab, and a good chunk was done during the reign, at least the first half of the reign of Uthman ibn Affan. During these early days of the Muslim expansion, most Muslims were Arab and most non-Muslims were not Arab. It's very easy to determine who had to pay jizya, and who did not. Yes, there were a few companions who were not Arab, but that was the exception and not the norm. That's just the Bilal and the Salman al-Farisi. Those were the exceptions. The vast majority of the first Muslims were Arab. And the vast majority of the people they conquered were not Arab. Talking about after the Prophet's death, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But over time, a lot of these non-Arabs either converted to Islam, they learned the message of Islam. You know, we're always given dawah. Muslims give dawah now, they gave dawah back then. Dawah is just something that we do. The Muslims were giving dawah back then, I can assure you, those Arabs were definitely giving dawah. So either they gave dawah and people became convinced about it and accepted Islam, or sometimes Arabs married non-Muslims, or maybe the non-Muslim woman converted to Islam. Maybe the non-Arab woman converted to Islam and then he married him. It doesn't matter. The point is that he married them and he would have mixed race Muslim children. Unfortunately, the Umayyad Caliphate refused to recognize most of these conversions. Now, they did recognize some of them, but they were almost always for political purposes. The Umayyad Caliphate refused to recognize these conversions, and these non-Arab Muslims still had to pay the jizya. And as Muslims, they also had to pay the zakat, so they were paying twice. They had to pay the zakat for religious purposes, and they had to pay the jizya for political purposes. So when the governor of Khorasan promised to end this evil practice of charging jizya on Muslims, and yes, it is evil because it goes against the Quran and the Sunnah, when he made this promise to end this evil practice, and then he backtracked, it fueled a revolt, and this revolt was led by an Arab man named Al-Harith ibn Suraj. Al-Harith ibn Suraj was an Arab Muslim who hated this policy of charging jizya on Muslims. So initially, he allied with the Mawali, the non-Arab Muslims of Khorasan. He allied with them against the Umayyads, but as the Umayyads started to win and started to crush this rebellion, he then went and allied with the non-Muslims, the Turks and the Khaganates, who had caused all that trouble at the Battle of the Defile and the Day of Thirst that I mentioned earlier. Al-Harith ibn Suraj, as of the time of this story that we're going to start today, is still alive and still living with the Turks, the non-Muslim Turks in Central Asia. Now, while all these things are going on, while the Umayyads are losing these major battles, while the Mawali are trying to fight for their rights, we have the Abbasids steadily on the rise. In the shadows of Khorasan, the Abbasid propaganda machine is growing. Several Abbasid Dais were executed, but despite these setbacks, the Abbasid movement, the propaganda, is still moving forward, quietly gathering strength right under the Umayyads' nose. So those two problems right there, the mistreatment of the Mawali and the Abbasid propaganda that's slowly growing. And the Umayyads don't really know how deep this network is just yet. And then finally, we have tribalism. In addition to the mistreatment of the Mawali, in addition to the Abbasid propaganda growing, we have this never-ending rivalry that we've been talking about for years on this podcast. The rivalry between the Northern Arabs and the Southern Arabs. And this rivalry, this strange feud between Northern Arabs and Southern Arabs has infected all levels of the Umayyad regime, both in the military and in the administration. Umayyad governors and the caliph, they play different groups against each other, different tribes against each other. The governor that belongs to one tribe, he gets dismissed, and then the governor from another tribe comes in and tortures his predecessor. It is just crazy. This strange thing where the tribalism is making people who speak the same language and practice the same religion pray towards the same Qibla, and they just can't stand each other. And these were all Arabs. We're not even talking about the Mawali. All Arabs. So at the end of season four, the caliphate is technically intact. Caliph Hisham is securely on the throne as the ruler and the leader of the Muslim world, but he doesn't know it, at least. The bonds that hold the caliphate together are brittle and breaking. Much of that is because Caliph Hisham and the Umayyads relied way too much on the Syrian army. The Syrian army, the Syrian military, was the backbone of the Umayyads' military strength, and it spread too thin across all these multiple fronts, and even internally, as it did with rebellions and stuff, internal rebellions. The Umayyad military is spread way too thin, and Caliph Hisham doesn't know it yet, but his base of power is about to break. It's about to break. So here's what you can expect for this upcoming season of the Islamic History Podcast / the Umayyad Caliphate. So in this season, inshallah, we are going to see the end of stability in the Umayyad Caliphate. Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, Caliph Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, has been ruling for a long time, but it's going to come to an end. And when it ends, when he dies, it's going to expose all of these weaknesses that we've spoken about within the empire, all these things that have been bubbling under the surface and have just kept under because they had a stable leadership at the top. When he's gone, all the weaknesses will be exposed. We've discussed this in the past, this never-ending mindset of warfare on so many fronts, the long deployments of so many soldiers, the caliphate's dependence, really over-dependence on Syrian troops, the mistreatment of the Mawali, the opulent lifestyle of the Banu Umayyah, yes, they're guilty of that too, and these high taxes to fund their lifestyle and their war machine, all of this is going to just tear the caliphate apart. We have lots of things to look forward to in this coming season, inshallah. We have Zayd ibn Ali's rebellion. In Kufa, Zayd ibn Ali, that's the great-grandson of Ali ibn Abi Talib, radiallahu anhu. Zayd ibn Ali is going to lead a revolt against the Umayyads. And like most of these rebellions, most of these, especially Shiite rebellions, but even the non-Shiite rebellions, Zayd's promise is to establish the Book of Allah and the Sunnah. We're going to see what kind of impact Zayd's rebellion has on the Muslim world. But that's not the only rebellion. The one that really breaks things, one that really tears things apart, the one that really ends the unified Islamic State is the Berber Rebellion of North Africa. The Berbers of North Africa by this time are mostly Muslim. There's still some pockets of non-Muslims here and there, but for the most part, they're Muslim. And now that they're Muslim and they are studying the religion, and da'is and teachers and ulama are coming to North Africa to teach the Berbers Islam, they can see the stark difference between the ideas of Islam and the actions of the Umayyads. The Umayyads could never have even captured Al-Andalus, Spain and Portugal, without the Berbers, and the Berbers know this, and they are not happy. They are not happy with the way that they're being treated for their sacrifices. So we're going to talk about that, inshallah, probably in the first episode of season 11. We're also going to see a string of weak and ineffective caliphs after Hisham ibn Abdul Malik returns to Allah. Al-Walid II is going to become the caliph after Hisham, but he has a very libertine lifestyle, so to speak, and he disregards lots of Islamic principles. At least that's what his detractors accuse him of. Allah knows best if they're really true. But his lifestyle, whatever, however true it may be, it alienates people and it angers the other members of Banu Umayyah and ultimately leads to a civil war. And with this civil war, the Umayyads turn on themselves. We'll have cousins going against cousins, assassinations, a coup in Damascus, and the unity of Banu Umayyah is going to shatter and fracture and break. And while all this is going on, The Abbasids are still underground, gathering strength in the background, gathering their recruits, making alliances. It's going to all come forward. Maybe not this season, inshallah, but it's all going to come out probably in the next season. So I want to talk about some of the major problems. I think I discussed a lot of them already, but I want to recap the major problems in the Umayyad Caliphate at this point. First of all, there are the finances. Waging war is expensive. Waging war is even more expensive when you don't win that much. And right now, the Muslims are really not winning that much. And since they're not bringing in enough money through conquest and plunder, they have to levy higher taxes on their own people, and it also leads to more corruption. So we have finances as one problem. Then there's manpower. With all of these battles going on and the Umayyads depending so much on the Syrian army, and the Muslims are losing battles and are losing battles while they're fighting for land that wasn't even very, very valuable. I mean, they're fighting in the mountains of the Caucasus and losing like crazy in the mountains of the Caucasus, the mountains of Afghanistan. I mean, they're losing these major battles in these sparsely populated, low value from an agricultural perspective, not from a people perspective, but from an agricultural perspective. They're losing these battles and not even for much. So even the few times that they did win, the soldiers who survived these battles returned with very little to show for it. Then we have that corruption that I mentioned earlier. One of the most, one of the most disappointing things that I've read, in addition to the Mawali, but the Umayyad governors were just so corrupt. I mean, there was just corrupt to the core. Every governor, when he came to power or took his position as governor of whatever region, he hoarded money. And when he was deposed, because the caliph dies or the caliph replaces one governor, brings in a new governor, whatever the case may be, a new governor would come in. The new governor would accuse the old governor of embezzlement and grift and theft and misappropriation of state funds, and would arrest him and torture him to find out where the money was. And as soon as he got the previous governor's wealth, this new governor would turn around and do the same exact thing. He would embezzle and grift and misuse or misappropriate government funds. And then a new governor would come in and do the same thing to that guy. It would just happen over and over and over again. And then we had that tribalism. Tribalism then as now, we might call it nationalism now, but tribalism was holding the Ummah hostage then just like it is now. The Northern Arabs and Southern Arabs were hostile to each other. The Iraqis didn't trust the Syrians. The non-Arabs were being treated as second-class Muslims, and everybody hated the Umayyads. At the center of all this turmoil was Caliph Hisham, and he was either unable or unwilling to recognize the danger that his empire was in, and that he was the only thing holding it together in this faint, vague, and diminishing loyalty to Banu Umayyah. That's all that was holding the caliphate together. And when he dies, it's going to all come falling apart. I want to take some time now to talk about Muslim society during the Umayyad Caliphate. I actually intended to put this in the first episode, but it didn't quite fit, and I'd already done all the research, so I want to include it anyway. So inshallah, we're going to talk about society, and much of this I've kind of already covered, but I'll go into a little bit more depth now, inshallah. Throughout this series on the Umayyad Caliphate, we've discussed politics and warfare, and quite frankly, I love talking about that stuff. But we haven't really talked much about the society in general. And I want to take a little bit of time to talk about that. For instance, the various cities within the Umayyad Caliphate, particularly the major ones, Kufa and Basra, and many other cities within the Umayyad Caliphate, we find that they're divided into neighborhoods based on tribal affiliation. I'm not sure if that helps with the tribalism issue. I'm pretty sure it doesn't, but that's what we have. But, you know, we have those things in our modern society as well. You have things where different ethnicities and different groups tend to congregate in one area, and that may just be the way people are. I mean, you don't have a Chinatown and a Little Italy and a Harlem in New York for no reason, because people of certain backgrounds tend to congregate or group or come together with people of the same background. However, in ancient urban cities like Damascus and Alexandria, they were also divided. They also had their tribal neighborhoods as well. These were also really ethnically diverse melting pots. So they weren't just divided based upon different Arab tribes. They would have been divided based upon, well, this is where the Copts live, and this is where the Turks live, and this is where the Jews live, and this is the Christian quarter, this is the Greek quarter, and this is the Arab quarter. Within the Arab quarter, you have all these different tribes of different Arabs and different quarters within the Arab quarter, things like that. These major cities, these major metropolises within the Umayyad Caliphate would have attracted people from all over because they were major cities, Damascus, Alexandria in particular, but also others, but specifically those two, because they were already major cities even before the Muslims came around, and they just kept on being major cities. Alexandria is right there on the coast of Egypt, so being right there close to the Nile on the coast of Egypt, it would naturally be on the coast of the Mediterranean, it would naturally be a huge gathering port for ships and businesses and merchants and stuff like that. And Damascus was already a bustling city once again before the Muslims came along, but now it was the capital of the largest empire in the world at that time, so yes, it's going to attract a lot of people. Listen to this quote from this book that has a little bit of Western bias, but I still found it interesting. Then as now, in the narrow covered streets, the Damascene, with his wide trousers, red pointed shoes, and huge turban, could be seen rubbing shoulders with a sun-tanned Bedouin in his loose gown, surrounded by kufaya, head shawl, and ekol, headband, and occasionally meeting a European-dressed ifrangi, or Frank. Here and there, the aristocrat, the well-to-do Damascene, might be seen on horseback, cloaked in a white silk abba, and armed with a sword or lance. A few women, and those all veiled, crossed the streets. Others stealthily peeped through the latticed windows of their homes, covering the bazaars and public squares. Sherbet sellers and sweetmeat vendors raised their voices to the highest pitch in competition with the incessant tramp of the passers-by and the multitude of donkeys and camels laden with the varied products of the desert and the town. History of the Arabs, from the earliest times to the present, by Philip K. Hitti. The Umayyads also provided infrastructure for their towns, especially the major ones like Damascus. It was generally the responsibility of the governor of the individual places to provide the infrastructure for the people living under his authority. Just like today, you don't find the president of the United States worried about streetlights in Topeka, Kansas. The mayor of Topeka and the governor of Kansas got to deal with that problem. Same thing then. The Umayyads didn't, or I'll say the Umayyad government in Damascus didn't necessarily concern himself with infrastructure projects in, say, Khorasan. The governor of Khorasan was supposed to do that. In Damascus, however, the Umayyads did take care of that city and that region. They did build things like canals and waterways to bring fresh water into Damascus, which allowed the individual houses to maintain like small gardens and fruit trees. And the houses in Damascus, like much of the Muslim world, even today, the personal homes of people were usually built around a central courtyard. While the cities of Damascus and Alexandria were very busy towns and very busy cities and bustling metropolises, the cities of the Hejaz, particularly Medina, Mecca, and Ta'if, these generally attracted people who were interested in Islamic scholarship. It also attracted those people who wanted to stay out of politics. The politics were taking place in Damascus, not in Mecca and Medina. So you find that many of the descendants of Ali ibn Abi Talib, after suffering so many losses at, for instance, the Battle of Karbala and the fighting between Ali and Muawiyah, many of the descendants of Ali ibn Abi Talib, they settled primarily in Medina. Likewise, the descendants of Al-Abbas, particularly Ibn al-Abbas, Abdullah ibn Abbas, they settled first in Ta'if before relocating to the Levant. And that's part of the whole Abbasid thing. We talked about that in season 4. I'm not going to really get into it this season. I don't plan to, at least. But for a while there, Ibn Abbas and his descendants and his family were living in Ta'if. They made Ta'if their home. The Hejaz was also flourishing due to the Hajj pilgrimage. The Hajj pilgrimage brought in people and wealth from all over the Muslim world. And with this wealth and this high level of piety in the Hejaz, there really wasn't much room for political instability. The political instability was taking place in places in like Khorasan. They had a lot of political instability. And Iraq, a lot of political instability out there too. And as we'll soon see, North Africa. But in the Hejaz, it really wasn't much there. There weren't, and there's lots of reasons for that. There weren't any soldiers really occupying the Hejaz. For instance, because Iraq caused so much trouble for the Umayyads in the past, they always had to maintain a garrison of soldiers there. And these were always Syrian soldiers who were loyal to the Umayyad regime. And the Iraqis did not like the Syrian soldiers, what they felt was occupying their land. In the Hejaz, you didn't have this problem because there was no need to put soldiers there. People were there for religion. People were there to stay out of trouble. People were there to learn about Islam. And also, there was no forward movement. The Hejaz is right there by the Red Sea. It's on a peninsula. There's nothing else to conquer but the sea. And so there's no reason to have a bunch of soldiers there to continue pushing for the Muslim boundaries because there were no boundaries to push for. That was the end of it. That was the end of the map as far as the Muslim world was concerned for that region. And so you find this area with lots of wealth due to the Hajj pilgrimage, very little instability, political instability, because there were no soldiers there, no occupying soldiers. And also the people were just more pious. They're more focused on Islam. So they basically tried to stay away from those political issues. So the Hejaz was very peaceful. But the Hejaz was a meeting place for the opponents of Banu Umayyah, especially the city of Mecca. The Hajj pilgrimage, as we all know, brought in people from all over the world. So this was an opportunity for the members of the various secret groups who hated the Umayyads to meet and conspire with each other. It was kind of dangerous to send letters by person. A person might get arrested, might die, might get searched by a soldier or by the Shurta, the police, or whatever the case may be. And then that letter could be discovered, and now all of a sudden the whole conspiracy is unraveling. But if you meet with each other in Mecca, and everybody knows when the Hajj pilgrimage is going to be, you meet once a year in Mecca, and you conspire. you conspire against the government while making tawaf. Not a good thing to do, but so people will come to Mecca to conspire against the government. That happened a lot. But the point is that other than that, the Hejaz was generally stable. And this concentration of scholarship in the Hejaz was also the beginning of the codification, the organization of Islamic jurisprudence. So those are the major cities and how they were set up. Let's talk about the tribes. And we already talked about some of the major tribal divisions. The southern tribes were known as basically Yemeni tribes. Then the northern tribes, generally known as the Mudari tribes. The Yemeni tribes basically dominated the military and the politics of Syria. They made up most of the soldiers of the Syrian military, and therefore they were the most influential. Now, of the Yemeni tribes, the Kalb were the most powerful. This is where this whole tribal thing stops making sense. Okay, the Kalb, even though they were considered amongst the Yemeni tribes, the Kalb had been in Syria long before Islam. Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan, in fact, married a Christian Kalbi woman. And that's how his son, Yazid ibn Muawiyah, came to be. I could not find any evidence that the Kalb originated from southern Arabia. As far as I can find, as far as I've been able to tell, Banu Kalb seems to have originated in northern Arabia, and they have been living there for hundreds of years, long before the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was even born. However, during the Fitan, the multiple civil wars within the Muslim world, Banu Kalb allied with the southern tribes that had migrated to Syria after the Muslim expansion began. And since Banu Kalb had this strong alliance with Banu Umayyah, the Kalb were the de facto leaders of the southern Arab faction, even though they seem to have been northern Arabs. That's why I said this whole tribalism thing was stupid. okay, for them to be sitting here being angry at each other when they're not even Southern, it just doesn't make any sense. But it is what it is. So as much as possible, the Umayyads prefer to appoint the Kaab, or members of Banu Kaab, to high positions of government because that's who they trusted the most. Now, there were northern or Mudari tribes in Syria, obviously. You know, the southern tribes there, they had most of the political and military power, but there were also many northern or Mudari tribes that had settled in and around Syria. Just they didn't have the political power that the southern Arabs had in that region. However, in other parts of the caliphate, political power wavered back and forth between the Mudard and the Yemeni factions. For example, the Muhallab family, they were southern Arabs. They were from southern Arabia. And at one point, they did hold lots of power and influence in the Umayyad Caliphate. But they ran afoul of Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, the powerful governor of Iraq that we discussed in the first 2 to 3 seasons of the Umayyad Caliphate. And when they got on Hajjaj ibn Yusuf's nerves, he demoted them, and eventually most of the Muhallab clan was wiped out. Not all, but most of them were wiped out by the Umayyads. Let's talk about social classes within the Umayyad Caliphate. Now, the highest ranking social class were, of course, the Muslim Arabs. You spoke about the different factions within the Arabs, Banu Umayya, Banu Hashim, the Yemeni, the Mudari, the Quraysh, and all that, but they're all Arabs. They're all Muslim Arabs, and these guys were at the top. The Muslim Arabs were at the top of the social order. After the Muslim Arabs came the Mawali. Yes, the Mawali were non-Arab Muslims. These included the Berbers of North Africa, the Persians of Iraq and Mesopotamia, the Sogdians and the Turks of Khorasan, the Visigoths of Andalusia, the Indians of Sindh, and the Nubians of southern Egypt. These were the Mawali, the different races and ethnic groups that made up the Mawali. And as Muslims, the Mawali enjoyed some of the benefits of living under Islamic law. For instance, they could hold government positions. It was pretty rare, but there were a few Mawali who actually did have government positions. They could also take part in military campaigns. Generally speaking, the Umayyads tried to avoid having non-Muslims fight for them. There were a few instances where they allied with non-Muslims, particularly in the Caucasus they did. But generally speaking, they tried to avoid that. So the Mawali could take part in warfare, and this could lead to higher rank and wealth. And even though they were treated as second-class citizens, most of their rights were still protected by Islamic law. The Umayyads couldn't just come and randomly, arbitrarily confiscate Mawali property without going through the chain of legal jurisdiction. There had to be some sort of court case to make that happen. And the Mawali could also take other Muslims, including Arabs, to court and sue them if for whatever grievances they may have had. The Mawali could also inherit from other Muslims, and they could also marry Muslims, for instance, Arab Muslims. That happened very often. The Mawali could marry into an Arab family. They could inherit from Muslim Arabs. So these were things that the next group, the non-Muslims, could not do. The downside, of course, was, as we mentioned earlier, the Mawali had to pay both jizya and zakat under Umayyad rule. And we know that this was against Islam and one of the major grievances against the Umayyads. Many Mawali did resist these unjust rules, particularly the Berbers of North Africa and Al-Andalus. And also there are many Muslim Arabs who married non-Arabs, Muslims usually, but not always. They married non-Arabs, and they didn't like the idea of their children paying jizya. And, of course, this whole practice was against Islam anyway, so whether they liked it or not, it was wrong. Doesn't matter. But we do see that there were many Arabs. I kind of make it seem, I don't mean to do this, I hope I'm not making it seem as this was like Arabs oppressing non-Arabs. No, this was the Umayyads oppressing non-Arabs. So we see that many Arabs rebelled against the Umayyads, partially due to their treatment of the Mawali. For instance, we have Al-Hadith ibn Sudayj, which we mentioned earlier. But in the past, you also mentioned Mukhtar ibn Ubaid during the Ibn Zubair era. And even beyond that, much of the appeal of the Abbasids were that they were Arabs who were promoting the equal treatment and proper treatment of the Mawali. So there were many Arabs who were against this wrong treatment. It was the Umayyad government that was doing wrong. After the Mawali, we have the non-Muslims living under Muslim protection. And these were Ahlul Dhimmi. I'm pretty sure if you follow the anti-Islam crowd, I'm not saying follow them, but if you listen to the anti-Islam crowd, they always talk about Dhimmitude and the Dhimmi state and all these stupid things they say. But yes, non-Muslims living under Muslim protection were Ahlul Dhimmi. The word Dhimmi comes from the Arabic word Idham, which means to grant protection or refuge. These guys, Ahlul Dhimmi, they had to pay jizya. They were prohibited from maintaining a standing army. However, they were not subject to Islamic law unless they had a grievance involving a Muslim, then they could be subject to Islamic law. Generally speaking, they could hold their own legal system based on whatever religious framework they had. We find this specifically with Christians and Jews. I'm not so sure about other religions. I have to look into that. But I'm not really certain of other religions, but definitely Christians and Jews were allowed to have their own legal system and deal with their own people, members of their own religions within the Muslim state by their own laws. That's why even though alcoholic drinks was banned for Muslims, non-Muslims could drink alcohol without punishment because it is against Islam to force Sharia on non-Muslims. So they couldn't force it on them. So non-Muslims were allowed to have alcohol. They were technically prohibited from selling it to Muslims, but I've done a lot of reading. Trust me, they definitely sold alcohol to Muslims quite a bit. That's neither here nor there. So this setup where you have Muslims governing non-Muslims and the non-Muslim religious groups basically had their own community within the community where they lived by their own rules. So long as they paid their taxes to the state and they didn't cause trouble, they're kind of left alone to their own devices. But they still, of course, received the protection from the Muslim government. This setup, we see that carrying out throughout much of Islamic history, even all the way up until the Ottoman Empire. Yes, even up until the 1800s, this was still going on. Ahlul Dhimmi was initially only for Christians and Jews. But over time, as the Muslims conquered a lot of people who are not Christians or Jews, this label was eventually applied to any non-Muslim living within the caliphate. So we have the shamanists of Khorasan, the Hindus of Sindh, the Buddhists of Sijistan, the pagan Berbers of Ifriqiya, the Christians and Jews of Al-Andalus. They were all considered part of Ahlul Dhimmi. Now, the Dhimmis, they often played a critical role in the administration, in the government bureaucracy, especially early on. So an example of this was with Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan. A Christian was one of his top advisors, and also one of the top advisors to his son, Yazid ibn Muawiyah. We mentioned in previous seasons of the Umayyad Caliphate how the Copts of Egypt, C-O-P-T-S, the Copts of Egypt basically controlled the papyrus-making industry. And also, we mentioned this before, I don't remember when, but the Umayyads depended and relied on Byzantine and Persian money, coins, for several decades before they finally started minting their own coins. Eventually, however, as Islam became more dominant, the Mawali began taking over these roles. So in the beginning, it was non-Arab non-Muslims handling much of this bureaucracy. But as these non-Arabs or their descendants accepted Islam, we see non-Arab Muslims taking over many of these roles. Now, the very, very bottom of the pecking order, very, very bottom were, of course, the slaves. Even Muslims who were slaves were at the bottom of the social order. However, a Muslim slave could be freed, and that would elevate them to a mawla. But the fact is that most of the slaves within the Umayyad Caliphate were not Muslim. A Muslim slave was the exception, not the rule. In most cases, the slaves within the Muslim world were defeated or conquered people. A Muslim army besieges a town or besieges a besieges a town, and the people of that town will go and take refuge inside the citadel or the fortress, and the Muslims will fight against the defenders of that fortress, and eventually the Muslims would be victorious. When this happens, when the Muslims conquer the town and conquer the citadel, the defenders almost always are put to death. They were almost always executed right away. There were a few cases where some of them might be sold into slavery, but the defenders were usually executed, or at least most of them were. The people who had taken refuge, the townspeople who had taken refuge within that citadel, now they were slaves. They're the property of the Muslims. They're not going to kill the civilians. For the most part, they didn't do that, but they are slaves. And so they would be sold into slavery. And it could be men, women, and children. So that's how you find women and children as slaves within this world, within the Muslim world. So, and it wasn't just Muslims doing it. As I just mentioned, tens of thousands of Muslims were taken slaves by the Khazars in the Caucasus when Ardabil fell. So it was happening on both sides. And yeah, slavery, slaves were bought and sold. It was part of the economy. There are even a hadith where Muslims were buying and selling slaves during the time of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So we'd have to run from it, but we also have to make sure that people don't try to make it more than what it really was, or try to make it seem like it worse than it really was. I find it, I'm going on a rant here. I'll rant and I'll get back on path in a moment, inshallah. I find it crazy that in a society where the worst atrocities within this country, I'm speaking of the United States of America, that some of the worst atrocities were done to slaves and their descendants. I find it ironic and completely hilarious that when those atrocities are brought up and the repercussions that are still being felt to this day, that the descendants of those former slaveholders would dare to point at what the Muslims did hundreds of years ago in a land thousands of miles away. Historically, slaves in the Muslim world were treated way better than anywhere else, including the United States. And yes, I know, a slave is still a slave. But come on, we did a whole series on Malik Ambar, who was technically a slave and conquered a good chunk of India. He was pretty much a kingmaker. Okay, so it's not the same. They can say it's the same, but it's not the same. All right, my rant's over. Back to the story. The reason why the Muslims continued to have to get slaves, it wasn't just that they were conquering. Truthfully, the Muslims kept freeing their slaves. They kept running out of slaves. They would free their slaves or marry them, and they would need more slaves. So that's one of the problems that the Muslims faced, is that they were constantly getting rid of their slaves by either marrying them or freeing them. One of the ugly truths that people don't like to mention is that before the Industrial Revolution, slave labor was needed to keep a major empire running. There are no pre-industrial empires, major ones. We're talking about little villages in the middle of nowhere. There are no major empires that could maintain without having slavery. They had to have a workforce, a low-paid or free workforce for these major projects. All right, let's close out by talking a little bit about Banu Umayyah and the nobility of the Umayyad dynasty. Banu Umayyah, they were the wealthiest, they were the most powerful people in the caliphate at this time, and they lived a life of privilege. There are many reports and many stories talking about all the un-Islamic activities of the caliphs and those close to him. I mean, we know from the stories of Yazid ibn Muawiyah, if you were listening, I think it's in season 3 of the Islamic History Podcast, we know the anger that was projected upon Yazid ibn Muawiyah due to his alleged and probably accurate drinking and partying. But there are also reports, which are completely impossible to verify, that the later Umayyad caliphs also drink alcohol and also enjoy the company of singing girls. Not all of them, definitely not Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, but there are stories that many of the other Umayyad caliphs, they drink alcohol, but these Umayyad caliphs, they had the discretion to enjoy these things from behind a screen or in private where nobody would recognize them. The Umayyad caliphs also enjoyed not so haram things like listening to poetry and hunting and polo and horseback riding. Storytellers were often invited to the palace to entertain the caliph with historical and mythical tales. Khalif Hisham himself was a big fan of horse racing. He reportedly had thousands of horses in his stable just for this. The people also liked like a rose-flavored sherbet. This was like a popular drink, especially with the women of the Umayyad Caliphate, but particularly the women of Banu Umayyah. But this love for extravagance, the horses and the partying and the drinking and all the stuff, this is what partially led to the Umayyad downfall. Caliph Hisham was known for being tight-fisted and stingy. Despite this reputation, he maintained thousands of horses just for racing. And he also built several palaces in the desert just for his enjoyment. You may think, okay, he built a palace, no big deal. No, these palaces also were accompanied by lush gardens, and they're in the middle of the desert. So how do you get that? If you build a palace in the middle of the desert, you're not going to be able to support some random garden that serves no agricultural purpose. This was not a farm. This was a garden just for the caliph's pleasure. So these palaces built in the middle of the desert, they required huge irrigation projects. And these huge irrigation projects require laborers and engineers and tools and materials. And all these things require money, and they were paid by the treasury. But to be fair, Caliph Hisham wasn't the first to do this, and he was not the last. So that will close things out for today, inshallah. I hope. It is my intention to drop the first full episode by January 12th, 2026. Maybe even before then, if Allah gives me the ability to do so. I will try, but January 12th, inshallah, is my go-to date. Don't forget, if you want to know the things that happen before we get to the current season of the Umayyad Caliphate, don't forget to check out the timeline. That is at IslamicHistoryPodcast.com/timeline. And please support this podcast. There's lots of AI slop out there. I am not giving you AI slop. I do the research myself. I buy lots of books. I read them, buy articles, watch videos. I read this stuff and I interpret it and put it into my own little format for you so I can try to explain it. This is a human doing these things. So I would appreciate any support you can offer. The best way to support us is to subscribe to the premium podcast that is Islamic History exclusive. Just go to patreon.com/Islamic History or search for Islamic History exclusive on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Podbean. Until the first episode drops, inshallah, that will close it out. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.